Hello, I'm Katie Manning, and you're very lucky because you're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio. Enjoy!
I'm Chris from Play Comics, a show where we look at video games based on comic properties and how well they stick to that source material, a part of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the show you're checking out now. Shows on the network are individually owned, and opinions expressed may not reflect others. Find other astonishingly geeky shows at GunnaGeekNetwork.com.
You've dialed into Gallifrey Public Radio. We're a podcast dedicated to positive enjoyment of everything in the Doctor Who spectrum. Join us for weekly discussions ranging from Hartnell to Whittaker and well beyond. Your hosts are Jay Witten.
I choose Death by Scotland.
Keir Hansen.
Arun, Arun, Arun.
And Haley Malley.
Darth Vader, he's a villain, right?
We travel through classic and new Who, explore the extended Whovian universe, and play a few games from time to time if we're left unsupervised. Oh, and a word on spoilers, we do discuss recent news, content that has been officially released, and the occasional interesting rumor, but don't worry, if we look too far into the future, we'll give you a fair warning.
Welcome to episode 338 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we found the land where the sun never sets, the worst do-it-yourself golf course cosplay ever constructed, and the definitive source material and inspiration for the attack eyebrows. I am your punctilious magnificence, Haley.
I am your supreme globosity, Keir.
And I am your benevolent aggrandizement, Jay. This week, we see what happens when Robert Holmes is given the rare opportunity, in the classic era, that is, to be both writer and story editor, as he hands us a take on corporate greed, taxation, and workers' revolt in the Sunmakers. You'd think he had a bit of a grudge against the Inland Revenue Services. You would be right.
Yeah, just a tiny one. Yeah. Little bit of a little baby axe to grind, I guess. So if I understand correctly from offline conversations here, this is a first time around for the story for both of you, right?
Yep.
Jay, since this is an opportunity for you to get kind of a real first take on this, what did you make of the Sunmakers?
I thought that it was actually a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. The even as heavy-handed as the preaching was, it was done in such a way that it was still enjoyable to watch. Everything was so over the top that it's like, I understand that you're trying to teach me something, but you've turned them into absolute caricatures, so I'm okay with it.
Right. Okay. Haley, what was your sort of high altitude take on this particular story?
I felt like it was a story that I'd seen before, like a type of story I've seen before. Every kind of exploration sci-fi show does one like this. Like I know I've seen a Stargate episode like this. I feel like I've seen a Star Trek episode like this with similar concepts. So it was nice to see one of the early ones.
Yeah. Okay. Agreed. I like the fact, Jay, when you mentioned things like the characters, the over the top nature of characters on all sides of the dynamic here, the company, you know, being what it is, and you expect that to be, you know, kind of this faceless corporate machine that, you know, cares absolutely nothing about, you know, the grunts that that are being exploited for the good of the profits and all. That
Walmart. I'm sorry.
That comes across just fine, but it's like, you know, let's paint an inch thick. Let's make these bombastic, you know, executive level characters, even down to the I know I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but when you get the guys driving the golf cart, right, the thugs with the helmets are the dumbest, just brute thugs. You know, one of them gets shot, or, you know, gets out of the cart and gets shot, and the other one pauses, waits a good solid 12-15 seconds, gets out slowly and steps forward just to be shot himself. It's so cartoonish, you had to enjoy it. But what about particularly our our hero squad, you know, the Doctor, Leela, and the sort of the relationship that we had been seeing getting better, sort of, you know, the corners rounding off on them in the last couple of stories. K-9's got big presence in this one. How did our TARDIS team strike you throughout these four episodes?
Yeah, it was, there were definitely some moments where the Doctor's just condescending nature towards Leela was very, very, like, it definitely rubbed me the wrong way.
Okay.
But the rest of the time, like, it seemed to work fairly well, aside from those moments where he's just blatantly disregarding her or, you know, talking down to her, whatever the case is. And it just served to highlight those times that he was being such a jerk. But
okay.
But I did enjoy it, though.
I'm thinking particularly, they fall into this pattern now of bookending these moments in the console room at the top and the end of the first and last episode. You know, the chessboard, the mucking around with K-9, you know, up against a computer mind or the fallibility of a computer mind, and Leela just being the one who's just there to move the pieces for K-9.
Yeah.
It's about as analog as you can get. But the banter that they get, I think, is really solid. I think some of the little needling that they do at one another, and Leela getting an opportunity to get some shots in, feeling comfortable enough to get some shots in. I could watch that stuff all day long.
Yeah, when Leela's actually, you know, taking part in the conversation and not just being, you know, talked down to, it's fantastic. When she's the one that's making the barbs and things like that, I absolutely love it.
I did notice, you know, mentioning K-9 specifically, that he, you know, and John Leeson, a lot of material in this. He's a far more integral part of this particular story. And his laser aim is getting better, too. That's all it was. But I think, from what I understand, Holmes having the status that he did as the story editor and being part of the principal decisions on where characters and casting and those things were going to be going, he knew maybe farther in advance than some of the writers that K-9 was going to be worked into these stories. So I think he probably had a little bit of an advantage to know how he was going to be able to work that dynamic, which is why I think we get so much more dialogue from K-9 and his involvement in the story. But did it feel at any point like they were trying to force us to take on this new character? I mean, K-9 was sort of he was ancillary for the stories that we've just been recently seeing. He's a tool. He literally is an object to be utilized. But now it's becoming more character-like. Is that sitting all right with you, or does it feel like it's being a little ham-fisted?
I feel like it worked fine. We've seen it before where an additional companion is added in after we've got our primary companion. It didn't feel any different from any other time it's happened.
Okay. And even the fact that they're doing this with a, you know, sort of anthropomorphizing this little robot, it has the same kind of comfort feel to it.
I mean, it works for me because I feel like that's that's no less gimmicky than when you bring in somebody that's like a specific profession where that becomes their role in every episode, or somebody from a specific time period where their out of placeness becomes a thing in every episode.
Yeah.
You know, this one just happens to be a robot dog, and that's the thing he's going to have going in every episode.
Got it. Yeah. They just find that they're running into a bigger issue than they had with the Daleks about getting him up one floor or down another. See him come rolling into a room. I'm like, I'm pretty sure there was like a high threshold on that doorway. How did he get in to the... never mind.
He's actually got thrusters like R2-D2. They just don't show him very often.
Nice. Although I will say, talking about changes of elevation and stuff, I started keeping a tally count of people going up and down ladders.
Oh, jeez.
And I lost count after about 15. It was just...
that is the only rule to the drinking game.
I guess that's where you go with the Sunmakers, is somebody up or down. Got it.
They're mixing it up. You know, they didn't want to do corridors this week, so.
So they did ladders instead.
Yeah, they did. Well, but all right. Well, in terms of the overall set, you could tell they were using, the rooftop sequences and things like that. But the changes on the internal, I thought actually this was a pretty clean looking set for the most part. When they were supposed to be getting down into the Undercity, and they didn't really want to do much design. They just gave it a black studio set and sort of hung some pipes and stuff. I found that a little refreshing because they weren't trying to give us something that, well, that looked kind of weather-beaten. There were a couple moments where they were going through some of the internal corridors and the sort of the camera would pan along, especially when it was following Canine along floor level. And you could see where some of the, like the set flats were dinged up and smashed from getting moved around and repainted and all these things. And they were, you could tell that they were working with, you know, repurposed materials in a lot of cases. So making a decision to say, all right, we need this vast undercity space. Let's just make it black and just let the audience interpret the rest was a nice call.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I definitely like the, it was almost a little jarring at first just because it was so sparse and it was just like, they really didn't spend much time at all. But after that initial kind of reaction, yeah, it did become almost comforting and just like nothing was distracting you from what was going on. And it was kind of nice. Yeah. Mm.
So we've got a bit of a multi-leg table here because we've got obviously our primary characters going up against the company, the most over the top megalomaniacal characters. I mean, Hayde and the Collector, no. The Collector.
Oh my God.
Is amazing. Will Jay, you'll be able to track with me on this, but when we get to like later characters that we meet, like Syl, you know, you can tell this is sort of cut from the same sort of, you know what? It's not enough. Go bigger. Was fantastic. So, but did you feel at any point like it, that it lacked teeth because these company representatives were so ridiculously bombastic and larger than life in their nature? Did it take away any of the legitimate threat factor?
Yeah, no, I definitely think it did, because it, the whole time, you know, that it's just okay, we're just biding our time until the revolt actually kicks off, until they actually get their comeuppance and things like that. You never actually thought that they would really pose much of a threat at all. I mean, even when they're going to steam Leela, even if it hadn't been Leela, maybe at that point you'd have been like, wow, these people are kind of evil, but you knew it wasn't going to happen. You knew it was just kind of a, we're trying to build the tension, but it never really actually, but it was fun to watch nonetheless. So I was okay with them not being legitimate threats, just because it was fun. Like, it's like, okay, I don't care if you're going to be, Snidely Whiplash. Yeah. You do it. It's fun. I don't actually have to worry about you being the victor here, because I'm just enjoying watching you fail.
Yeah. And sometimes you can enjoy a villain without nuance. Like, this is the bad guy. He's a tax collector. He's trying to take away your hard earned money, or just not let you have any money. Like,
Yeah.
You know, a bad guy that you don't sympathize with is nice every once in a while.
Right.
True. Yep. But I love the little, well, steaming, by the way, I mean, that sounded on first impression, you're like, that's a horrific means of execution.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's much healthier than frying.
Oh, well, yeah. It's good. It's like a giant instant pot. But didn't Hayde call the Collector most merciful during the execution? Like, he's asking for details on it.
There were so many superlatives thrown out. I have no idea. Yep. Like, this is the other side of Colin Baker's coin, where he gets the most delicious insults and stuff like that. And this guy is just the complete antithesis.
Mm-hmm. But there always seems to be some, well, in many cases, there seemed to be some sort of double entendre to the titles he bestows upon the Collector. Like, he's really kind of saying something a little bit more there, like the most merciful during an execution. Okay. But all in all, I did notice, correct me if I'm wrong on this, because it's still, maybe I miss details every time I go through this that sort of register with me when I'm really kind of digging for the minutia. But if the company's records knew all about Gallifrey, had all the information on the Time Lords, we don't know exactly how far in the future this was really taking place, where colonization had gone from Mars and then off to Pluto and so forth. Mm-hmm. But the Doctor didn't even know about what was happening on Pluto. Like, this was something that was sort of outside his scope of knowledge, either too far in the future, somewhere he hadn't really experimented with and didn't know what was going to be happening with the human race at this point, or there were just sort of gaps in that knowledge, but they knew about the Time Lords. That seemed like a really interesting kind of flip in the knowledge base there.
Yeah.
Well, maybe it's such a small blip in the history of humankind that the Doctor has vast knowledge of, that it's like, you know, one of those footnotes in his textbook. Like, because they burned through all the resources on Mars, burned through the resources on Pluto, and it just happened really quickly.
Right, right. Well, what were some of the, like, when it came down to, I have my opinions of the, you know, we're talking about the sort of the multiple sides of this. So we've got our, you know, we've got our TARDIS team, we've got the company, but then we also have the sort of the in-betweens, right? There's the affected citizens. You know, we start out this whole story meeting Cordo and hearing his plight, trying to pay for his father's funeral, pay extensively for his father's funeral. But then we've got Bisham too.
Yeah.
Who I'm kind of fascinated by, because I don't know whether or not I like him as many times as I've seen this, because it seems like he's like Captain Exposition. Literally, they're strapped to the table next to the Doctor and just spewing all of this information to fill in the gaps during that particular episode. And I still don't know if I like it. As endearing as I think the character is, I think what his role in the story still bugs me.
That I can agree with. I was going to say I loved him just because it's like, it doesn't matter what the situation is. He is just out over the top optimistic. It's just, this is the greatest thing in the world. And, you know, he's the computer from the ship in Hitchhiker's Guide.
Yep.
Everything's fantastic. Doesn't matter what's going on. So,
yeah, I get that.
I liked him as a character. Yes. Yeah. His role really didn't. He easily could have been cut from the story and really wouldn't have affected much of anything aside from just bringing the whole tone down a bit. Mm. But I mean, maybe that's the whole reason why they kept him in, is just because it's just, you had to have somebody that was like, this is a fantastic thing. Let's go do the thing.
Right.
Because I mean, it is some heavy material if you want to let it get that way. So this kind of kept it from getting maybe a little bit too heavy handed and political and helped keep that almost cartoony feel to it all.
I guess so, yeah. A lot more screen time for Jelly Babies in this one too. They become quite the tool of use in the story. So I'm noticing that that gunfights on this particular program are still not a strong suit, and everybody's lousy shots. And so all the great fight coordination and choreography that's done for a lot of the melee fighting from story to story, when it comes to arranging gunfights, still not working out quite right. Timing what to take, what to take refuge behind as people are taking shots at you. Still not so great. But,
well, you know, it's kind of difficult when you're, you know, trying to take a shot and it fires off at some oblique angle, you know.
although when it comes to the some of the more violent moments, I guess you could say, it brings me immediately to, you're talking about, you know, Leela getting prepared for the steamer. When she's first captured and they're dragging her in, that rage pouring off of her was incredible. It was some of the best we've seen from Louise Jameson. I thought I could watch those sequences over and over and over because she was literally spitting mad. It was awesome.
Yeah, definitely some of my favorite scenes from Louise Jameson are in the story.
Mm. I understand that she wasn't satisfied with with a lot of things with the nature of the production at this point, and things were kind of, you know, getting a little wrangled at this time. But she still still to this day looks back on this as her favorite serial.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Haley, let me ask you a question though, just because Keir's seen this a couple times and it's still fresh in your mind. When we're first introduced to the Collector, when Hayde walks in there and he's going over the list or whatever, did you have that moment as well where you're like, why the hell is he sniffing the paper? Because he's like literally got his nose rubbing up against it while he's written it. I didn't notice it. I'm sitting there thinking, I'm like, is he smelling that? Like, is it? I thought it was like some interesting like introduction of like, oh, that it would translate by scent now or something. It did not translate well to the visual medium.
I don't know. I there's some interesting choices through this one.
I feel like he's just supposed to be like flamboyantly evil. So,
oh, no,
like,
I get
of
that.
Of course he's sniffing the paper. Like he even likes to smell you losing your money.
It's a full sensory experience. I think, though, personally, as far as like choices and sort of character representations, I still find one of the most fascinating characters in this entire thing was Mandrill, because he's so singularly focused on just being a lookout for number one survivalist. He's not evil necessarily. He's not shady or oily or anything like that. But he's just, you know, he's not a coward and he's not power hungry. He doesn't want to be the leader of these rebels or anything. He just wants to just survive. And I just find that really interesting. You don't often get that character type in these classic stories that is just, you know what, these people are following me, but if they were there or not there, it wouldn't make any difference to me. Means to an end.
Well, and that's, unfortunately, that kind of highlights the fact that it was very much like an individual kind of thing, because none of the other rebels really stood out to me very much. Like, you easily could have gotten rid of them and had, you know, a just unnamed person over there doing the exact same thing, and it just, they didn't really stand out well enough to me. And like, Mandrill did. Mandrill actually had some lines to him, some interesting, I don't want to say development, but, you know, it's like, he actually took part in the story much better, and it was like, okay, I remember you. I remember the things you did. The other ones, I'm like, they just, every time they were on screen, I'm like, okay, but get back to the people that matter.
Okay. Well, I think Gowdry as the sort of the, you know, looking for leadership character was fine. And Veet, I just loved her reactions to things, especially when the uprising starts and, you know, and they're starting to actually build some momentum as they come up from the Undercity. She was always the one going, yeah! She's always kind of, I love the way that she was playing it.
I loved the potential of the characters, but they felt wasted in the story.
Okay. But all in all then, so what about just the sort of the execution of the story on the whole? I mean, I don't think personally didn't detect any kind of pacing issues, even when it was a matter of, okay, we realize that we're going to have this revolt. Let's get everybody up to speed on this, everybody on board. I didn't feel like that took necessarily too long. Rising up to our climax points seemed pretty comfortable, pretty acceptable. I don't even know if I'd want to trim anything from these.
Right, because you introduce, like, the world you're living in, you introduce the bad guys, and you have to introduce what's going to be our rebellion force. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like it all happened at a pretty quick pace.
Right.
Yeah.
Did the, I think if anything was, could have stood a little bit more time, or could have been given a little bit more time to really work it through, was the chemical manipulation. You know, the idea of the gases and doing the little bit of a mind control in that regard. It got used occasionally, but it felt to me like that could have been far more of an intrinsic way of the company keeping the thumb on the working population.
But, yeah, no, that definitely. Honestly, that could have been a story unto itself.
Mm.
Like you easily could have turned that into the main plot point, and the social, the classism and stuff like that, something completely different. But
right, But as we knew, Holmes really had something he wanted to say with this.
Yay, economics.
But throwing the gatherer off the building, and you'll have to go back. Just do me a favor, since this was your first watch through, go back and grab that sequence again. However, 6 minutes before the end of the final episode or whatever, when they toss him over and there's the whole crowd there, they collectively toss the body. You hear them all go, hooray, it's like this funny little group chorus. I could loop that endlessly. As you see the dummy go tumbling over, hooray!
I didn't catch that because I was too caught up in the fact that the gatherer was just the whole time they're carrying him. He's like, he's getting, as he's being thrown over the edge, he's still like, you're just talking all kinds of trash and stuff. It's just like,
Oh, yeah, telling them all the violations that they're that they're causing.
I loved that so much.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so I would say at this point, we talk about rewatchability and recommendability. Haley, where would you stand on either of these when it comes to the Sunmakers?
I definitely rewatch. It was pretty enjoyable. I had fun the whole time. Well, you know, as much fun as you can have when people are being steamed. I would absolutely recommend it. You know, we've got, you know, K-9 and Leela and the Doctor working together as a team in a way that I think we haven't seen up to this point. I think this is the most K-9 we've really seen at this point in the series. So A+ on rewatchability and recommendability.
Cool. Okay. Resounding. Jay?
I'm going to have to agree. I'm going to rewatch this one without question. Once I find a little bit of free time, I'm definitely going to do it again. And yeah, this is absolutely one that's just, I mean, I always kind of go into the recommendability as like, what's the scenario in which I would recommend this to somebody or something like that? Because if they're just going through their own, well, of course they're going to hit it. But like, this is one of those that just, unless you're trying to convince someone that this is a serious show that doesn't get overly goofy, one, that's a lost cause. I mean, they're going to find out that you're lying to them eventually. this is a lot of fun. And if somebody watches this and goes, I didn't enjoy it at all, period, this show's really not going to be for them at all. So,
yeah. Well, I agree with you both. This is one where just the fun factor of the story stands on its own. And recommendability, because of the fact that it doesn't require a lot of real lead-in understanding.
Yeah.
If you don't really know the Fourth and Leela dynamic very well, or if you're not terribly familiar with where K-9 fit into the whole mix, it sort of eases you in because you see him in the beginning, just being, he's there in the TARDIS, he's playing chess with the Doctor. Okay, so this is some sort of a artificial intelligence that is utilized. Okay, got it. Leela's being treated somewhat better in this story, so it doesn't have quite that rankling that makes you wonder, why would she even put up with this? She's an assassin. She defended damn self. But yeah, and then it closes off rather succinctly and ends on its typical kind of, punchline gag at the end with the Doctor tipping the TARDIS sideways so the chessboard collapses. it's a nice little enclosure. I'm cool with it.
Right. We ready to jump into the news?
Let's.
Sure.
So you mentioned our Sixth Doctor a little earlier, Jay. Mm-hmm. We have been handed the news that another Blu-ray set is being put together. They're doing a bit of a jumping around in the way that they're attacking these seasons. But I'm so glad that they're doing the one that they just announced, because this is one of my personal favorites. And I will die on this damn hill, even if I'm alone.
Dude, I'm right there with you.
Okay. All right. So season 23, which we know as the Trial of a Time Lord series, is going to be released on in a Blu-ray box set with a lot of additional features. But they've been having so much fun with this one, as we were seeing as they were teeing up some of the Fifth Doctor's seasons and all the extra stuff they were doing with Janet Fielding and all this great, and Sarah Sutton and such. We're even for the promotion of this, they've been having some fun with it, because being the Trial of a Time Lord, they asked Colin Baker to come in, shoot some promo material. They put him on trial for parking offenses, I think. I think it was parking offenses. And he gets to, play the kind of bombastic, sort of the how dare you even waste my time with all of this kind of approach. Slips right back into it. But you gotta watch the whole promo so that you can get the little button on the end when they finally put him in a holding cell at the end of it all. And he's sitting there next to Nicola Bryant. Camera pulls back and he's like, what are you in for? And she says, marrying Brian Blessed. It's so perfect. Tons of extra features on this one. They said they're going to be cleaning it up and using the best possible sources. I had originally thought that this was only going to be available in the UK because you can get it for pre-order right now. It's not coming out until September. You could pre-order it on Amazon.co.uk. It's not even listed, as far as I've seen, as of today on Amazon in the US. But the articles say that it's going to be released at the same time. I don't know if that's true. We'll wait and see, because I'd be lining up for this right now. I don't buy a lot of Blu-rays, but because of the features, I can't miss this one.
Yeah, no, this is definitely one that's going on my list. I'm going to have to get this one because, I mean, like you said, this is one that I enjoy immensely, and just being able to dig into the special features, just that sells it to me right there.
Mm. One thing I know that is only going to be released in particular markets has to do with another Fathom Events broadcast or simulcast or simul screening or however we categorize these things. So, again, really pleased that they're continuing to do this. We got it with Legopolis, and they're yeah. taking, but we're coming up on the 10th anniversary of The End of Time, parts 1 and 2, close of David Tennant's era. And they decided huh. that they're going to put it up on the big screen, which is kind of a cool approach.
Yeah. Just the fact that 10 years since Tennant. Like, I mean, Kier, you and I have children that have never lived in a world without Doctor Who.
Yep.
Like, let that bake your brain for a minute.
Yep. I got the thing I want to find out a little bit more as we get closer to the broadcast time on this, because they're going to do this in August, right? They're doing it as close to the actual original air day, August 7th, I think. Is when they do these Fathom events, whether it's classics or some of the new stuff, they give you a little something extra for coming in to see, you know, quote unquote, older material, but you're coming back to see it. So they've got, maybe it's being done in conjunction with a Blu-ray release or something like that. So they're going to give you some of the extra features, you know, stick around after the credits for an interview with your doctor or something like that. So with this, because they're just doing it as an anniversary, strictly based on the calendar, I don't think they're doing any sort of re-release of the material digitally or on any sort of distribution format. So what's the ad? Mm-hmm. You know, what extra stuff are they going to give us, if anything? Or are they just going to do episode one, you know, or part one, part two, roll credits, lights up?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure that they probably have something, some kind of DVD extra that never actually made it onto the disc or something like that, that they'll probably tag on there. But it's rare that they ever, I don't think that I've been to one of these yet where they haven't had something on there. You know, even if it's just a quick little thing that somebody on the show recorded, just introducing it.
Right. Right. Okay. Well, we'll see. I mean, I'm going to go. That's a given. I'd like to know if there's going to be a little something extra. I'm going to hand you this next one because I just giggled through it.
our doctor had a birthday recently.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jodie Whittaker turned 37, and it ain't no party like a Time Lord party. That's all I'm going to say, because Mandip Gill shared a picture from set of Jodie in her birthday get up, and it is incredible.
Is that true Disconium? I'm wondering if the dress she was wearing was our famed Disconium material, or not, or if it's just extra sparkly. Because
I don't know.
The giant oversized pin and the tiara,
the wings.
The wing, yeah, everything.
Oh, I didn't even notice the wings.
Yeah, if you're gonna go big. But here's the kicker. So this is from Mandeep's Twitter feed, mm-hmm. right? And so she posts this and says, you know, she dressed like this on her 37th birthday on set, and says, you know, she's my idol. But the face she's wearing in that photo does not look like she's idolizing Jodie at this point. Pretty sour expression. And Bradley, too, is like, maintain stoic demeanor. And Tosin.
Well, it says she came to work like this, so I wonder if it, like, delayed their start time that day.
Well, having to wear the wings, getting out of the car, they get caught in the doorway and stuff.
I don't know. I kind of feel like both Mandip and Bradley are trying to play the straight man. Like, they're consummate professionals, and it just helps to offset the outfit.
And Tosin just can't wrap his head around what he's standing next to. I think he's still flabbergasted.
No, he's eyeballing those wings. He's like, man, I wonder if I'm going to get a turn.
Do I get a pair of those on my birthday on set? Oh, and last thing, and this is actually, I'm kind of glad that this this note came around when it did, because we had just fielded an email just the other day from one of our listeners, Hynek, mm-hmm. who was asking about access to classic stories, right? Mm-hmm. And whether or not there are a particular set of preferred resources. You know, he's got some of the DVD and Blu-ray sets, you know, but what do you do about some of the ones that you don't have? And I had responded to him just right prior to this, or getting this particular article, that, you know, there's BritBox, you know, and there's a library, and there's you know, there are a couple of other sites out there for some of the streaming content. Twitch will do their watches every once in a while, but the one that had been starting to gain a bit more attention was this Pluto TV, right? The thing, I hadn't experimented with it yet, but I love the fact that it's a free service, mm-hmm. But there's a catch, sort of, because it's almost old school style. You can catch the classic episodes, but you've got to plan your viewing because they broadcast them on a schedule,
right?
With commercial breaks and stuff. So it's like
a schedule.
Yeah, like it's like a TV guide, you know, confounding DVRs everywhere. So it's appointment based, really.
Yeah.
But it's still, I mean, it's the entire available back catalog of classic stories. So you're obviously not going to get, you know, any of the reconstructions and those things. And I don't know whether or not they're going to incorporate the animated reconstructions that just got added over the last couple of years, but I would imagine so. Twitch did. So, But yeah, it's a great resource.
Yeah. I mean, currently as we're recording right now, as soon as we're done, I'm going to finish watching episode 3 of The Curse of Fenric because that's on right now.
Mm-hmm. But only in the US, correct?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So this is only available here stateside. Sorry, Canada.
Yeah. Again. Yes.
Again.
So,
but Canadians have other options, though.
Space TV. I'm not really sure what they
have. Also, sampling, right?
Mm. Yeah. Mm. But it seemed kind of timely. So, Nick, there's your answer. Mm-hmm. And we'll put links to these in the notes, so you'll have these with the release, and you can go and check them out for yourself and watch along with us. I don't know what sort of have you been checking this out for a while? Do you know what kind of sequence? Are they following any sort of chronological release on this, or are they just doing sort of mixing it up?
So there's the they keep the stories together. So like Curse of Fenric is on right now, but then right after the end of Curse of Fenric, we go into the Brain of Morbius. So
okay.
Yeah. So they're going full PBS on this.
Yeah, yeah. But at least keeping the stories intact. So
yes, yeah. There is that much.
Cool.
So yep. But so what's on the horizon for next week?
Well, by our rotation, we're back to Torchwood next week. So we are headed into third episode of our first season. So that's the Ghost Machine. Mm-hmm. So yeah, definitely a bit of a turn from where we were in the last episode. So
a little bit. Yeah.
So pleased. Yeah.
All right. Well, this has been episode 338 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, man, I really need to step up my eyebrow game.
And this is Gear saying, this interview is terminated.
And this is Haley saying, I owe my soul to the company store.
We'll see you guys next week.
And I'll see you.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.gunnageek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.